Church is a community and movement, a fellowship of discovery. We desire to love well and serve often, while together we explore the adventurous love story of Jesus.
Well, welcome to Journey. My name is Jamie. I'm one of the pastors here. Great to be back with you. Are we looking for some seats? Do we need some seats? We good? All right, we can do the handheld thing. Hey, I got any seats anywhere? If you got any seats next to you, would you raise your hand up with how many fingers... with how many fingers you currently have on your hand? However many seats? Okay, you guys are with me. All right, you got it. Thank you. Awesome. Any more? We got a bunch of one-offs. Anybody single near those one-offs? She left. Welcome, those who are in the overflow room. Someone's coming to join you. Okay. I'm going to get in trouble. I'm going to get focused. Okay. So we're in a series called The Storyteller, and it's a series about Jesus and his wonderful, marvelous stories that he told. Last week, Kevin shared with you a story and talked a little bit about fairness. It's a wonderful message, by the way, if you weren't here last week and you want to catch that on podcast, those are on podcast. I was in Africa and had an amazing time. I took my 19-year-old daughter with me, and that was the highlight for me, just being with my daughter. But there was a guy named Scott who works with an organization called Compassion. He's been after me for a couple of years, and hey, come on, I want you to see what Compassion does. And I'm like, I've heard of Compassion, and I know of lots of different nonprofit organizations that work with extreme poverty, and I bless that and go for it. But you know. Blessings. And he just stayed on me, man, just please come see, I want you to see on the ground what we do. And I said, well, I've been praying. In the early days of Journey, we did a lot of mission work in Brazil. And I did mission work before that for about 10 years in Brazil. I said, well, I want to go to Brazil. He's like, well, we were in Brazil too, but I got this Africa trip, come with me. So Ashton and I went. And I got to tell you, so I'm 25 years of ministry, I'm a preacher's kid, so I'm 48 years old, been on the planet and around ministry a long time. I know some of you guys work with Compassion, like we have people who work with the organization. Wow, I was blown away, I'm a skeptic. I go in, and I was just so impressed with, you know, one of the things that impressed me the most. So first of all, they're watching at street level how they're literally making an impact on the lives of children. Truly, I mean, I had conversations with several of them. One of them, his name is Raphael. He said, I grew up in a dump. I lived in a dump. And Compassion came to my area of town. He said, I didn't know it was Compassion, and here's the thing that's so impressive, it was a church. There are no Compassion tents, there's no big Compassion branding. Compassion finds a church that has common values, a common understanding of Jesus, and then they use the church so that the church is the hero. Is that amazing? That they don't have to get any credit. That the church is the hero. And so he's like, a church said, hey, we can help you and give you food. And I found out that some person in America sponsored me and began to give money once a month, and it pulled me out of the dump. And I wound up getting an education. I had enough food. And he was one of our guides. I mean, incredibly articulate, funny. I mean, obviously a successful young man at what he does. And I said, well, what would be the difference? He goes, well, I have one brother who's in a gang. I have one brother who's got mental problems. It just so happened that someone sponsored me. And my life has changed. And I was just so impressed with the fact that not only were there layers of organization and accountability and all those things, but they basically were like, hey, look, we want to do this through the church. And so the local church is making a difference in their community. I learned this. This really blew me away. So in the last 25 years, extreme poverty in the world has been cut in half. Now, that's good news. We don't hear a lot of the good news, do we? He said, literally, Compassion recently put an innovation team together because they said if they can continue to work at the pace they're working, in the next 25 years, they may be able to eliminate extreme poverty around the world. We would literally work ourselves out of a job. I was like, and he said, because it's truly making that kind of difference. Just as a word of encouragement, I mean, sometimes you go to a concert and you hear someone doing a thing about child sponsorship, or maybe you see a thing on TV or on Facebook or something. Some really wonderful news. There are people who are really making a difference in the kingdom. And so be encouraged by that. And of course, I'm sitting with Scott, and I'm blown away. I'm like, wow, okay, so I'm sold on compassion's ability. I'm like, so do you have anything in Brazil? I mean, we're in Africa. And he's like, yeah, we got all kinds of stuff in Brazil. I'm like, all right, so let's talk about Brazil. So yes, I have my Brasileiro friend right here. So be praying. You know, we the last couple of years of Journey, if you're new with us, we kind of had to work out what was happening with us right here at home for a while. Kind of get settled. We moved into this part of town, new city, new piece of property. We knew we had to expand the space that we're in. But there really has been this burgeoning thing for the last 6 months and we had planted 10 churches or been a part of it in our first 10 years of our history. We love church planting. We love doing mission work around the world. So there's just kind of like, okay, we have things settled here. And just this kind of like, man, how we serve in the world again. And we served in Nicaragua. We've served in Haiti for about 10 years. And so just pray with us as we really start to get focused again on making sure we're taking the beautiful message and love story to the nations. Be praying with us about how we do that. So I'm going to tell you a story today. In order to tell you the story, I got to give you some context. But before I go into the story, if you're new with us, let's set it up with why stories. Why did Jesus arrive, and why didn't he give facts and information? Why didn't Jesus say, hey, you, and you, I got 12 of you, great. I need a number 2 pencil. Here's a bubble test. I need you to fill this in, make sure you get the right answers. I'm going to give you a couple of things you need to know, and then we're going to have a little ceremony. I'm going to put a robe on you, ask you to move a tassel, have a little song, and then you're qualified to go and preach the gospel to all nations. Like, why wasn't that Jesus' design? Why didn't he lead from facts and information? Why didn't he go, let's make sure we all settle quickly on a doctrinal statement? Why does he weave story after story through his moments with both friends and enemies? There's a great line by Kurt Thompson. He says this in the book Anatomy of the Soul. He says, when you keep your relationship with God and others exclusively fact-based and rational, it's easy to make judgments about others and yourself. Your heart's not engaged. You just keep it informational. It doesn't become real. What happens when you tell stories? Stories get your heart engaged. One of the things he talks about in that book, Anatomy of the Soul, is that literally, if you tell your story to an empathetic listener, physiologically something happens in both of you. The act of an empathetic exchange through story actually changes you. There's a power in story, not just because it elicits emotion, but it's actually physiologically doing something to us. There's this great power in story. So what did Jesus, why, and then what? Why did Jesus come and tell stories, and for what purpose? Well, what did he have to contend with? Well, let me give you this frame, kind of set up the context, and then we'll do the story. Here's what he had to contend with. He came into a society that had Imperial Rome. So you already had this oppressive empire. I mean, so like Star Wars fans, like, I mean, the empire was in charge, all right? So you had the empire that was completely ruling. And then within the empire, you had this religious faction. There was a left wing and a right wing. The right wing were the Pharisees. They were the fundamentalists, Sadducees. They were a little bit more liberal, but they were both in control. And they maintained control primarily through fear and shame. So those were mechanisms. Here's how we will control you. Through fear and through shame, through condemnation. So when you set yourselves in authority, you set yourselves up as an opportunity to judge. So, which by the way, happens with us all the time. So just in case if you're in the story and like, man, those bad Pharisees and Sadducees. Oh, we're Sadducees. We're both all the time. We're Pharisees and Sadducees. Here's the deal, because why? Every time we make a judgment about another, we're setting ourselves up as authority. If you made an observation about someone's behavior and how you didn't like it, you basically were saying, as I have observed your behavior, I've deemed that it's not good enough, or it's weird, or it's goofy, or whatever. I'm the judge because I'm in authority over you. Why am I in authority over you? Because I'm highly opinionated, because I'm right about everything, because I have more money, because I have the right religion, because I'm generally smarter than you. Pick whatever the mechanism is. But that's how we judge. That's how they judge. So, but it wasn't like just a random, like, oh, they're really struggling with judgment. No, the whole system was judgment. So it was condemnation and shame 24/7. So Jesus has to come in, and he functions in two ways. Number one is that he functions as a prophet in confrontation with the system. So he's speaking to these religious leaders. He's challenging them. I mean, there's confrontation. As a prophet, he's jarring the system itself by telling powerful stories or making provocative statements. But he also, at the same time, has to educate the common person who doesn't know what they don't know. This is their normal. This is how life is. He somehow has to pique their interest. He somehow has to create curiosity. He somehow has to help reshape the way they see. He has to create a new paradigm. How does he do it? He does it through stories. And he is the master storyteller. So I'm going to tell you one of the stories that he told. And this is one of the odd stories in the New Testament. And one of the reasons it's odd is because I can't really think of any story that does this well. It completely is in contrast to a common morality tale. So again, remember, so 613 rules, and then the Pharisees and Sadducees had lots of other rules beyond that, but there was like a baseline foundation of you got to keep these 613 rules, and then other ones. And sometimes the rules, they just make them up as they go. But so it was a rule-driven society. So basically it was, if you behave this way, you'll get this. So there's a lot of, if your whole life was functioned like an if-then statement. Behave this way, you'll get this. If you don't behave this way, you're not going to get this, or you're going to get this, and it's not going to be good. So everything's behavior modification measured by behavior. So Jesus is telling stories. What he has to do? He has to disrupt the morality tale. So he has to somehow come in and go, actually, your relationship with God does not rely on your behavior. Now, I'm going to go to the story a second, but before I do, real quick, I want to think about this for a second. Because we're here 2,000 years later, and I suspect some of us are actually still struggling with the exact same thing. Here's what I mean. How many of you, maybe this week, yesterday, today, a month ago, but you had a space, you go, oh, I feel kind of disconnected from God. My relationship is just, I don't know, kind of non-existent, or it feels really dry. Or maybe it's more extreme, like I feel a lot of shame. I'm angry with God. And you have enough, you kind of have this moment, you're reflective enough to go, I don't like that. I actually believe in God, I love God, and this isn't good. I want it to change. What, for most of us, is the first thought or action when it comes to, once you have the compulsion, like things aren't right with me and God, and I want it to be different, what typically happens next? Most of us go, well, what do I need to do? So what are some things we do to reconnect with God? You go, well, I need to ask for forgiveness, or receive forgiveness, or I need to repent, or maybe if I did my quiet time, or I should listen to a podcast, or I need to read a really cool statement on somebody's Facebook that'll be a great line from a desert father. I need to, something to make me feel better about myself. Because right now I don't feel right with God, so if I can do a thing, we'll be good again. Anybody have that temptation? Do you feel that? What's the contrast? I'm in shame. I feel I'm dry, I'm disconnected, whatever the thing is. And I go, oh, God, I feel so gross. I want to be connected to you. How many of us start this way? Oh, who am I? I'm a child of God. I'm passionately loved. Judgment and condemnation were absorbed on the cross. What I do is irrelevant to this. Grace has been poured out upon me generously. I'm an expression of the divine. We're okay. I'm loved. I just need to awaken. Mine's not an action, it's an awakening. I'm just opening my eyes and acknowledging what's already true. Oh. Ah. You love me. I love you. Hey, since you love me and I love you, probably be helpful for there to be some action. I think I want to go read your word, be reminded of the depth of that love. You know what? I think I'm going to make sure I join my church on Sunday when we gather. Out of love, recognizing who I am, I want to reinforce that depth and understanding in my life. Now, do you see the difference? Do you see the radical difference of those two action points? One is, I feel gross, I need a behavior that makes me feel better about myself. One is, oh, actually, I'm in love, I'm already loved. And my action, whatever the doing is, follows from being. Jesus had to deal with a system that was completely and pervasively this way across the board and had been for a very long time. So he has to disrupt this. He has to somehow disrupt this way of thinking. So here's the story. Before I tell the story, two more aspects, two more sets of context. First of all, Jewish people of the day really admired successful business people. Jewish people of our day really admire successful business people. Jewish people of our day typically are successful business people. There's a theme throughout history. So if you hear a story about a wealthy landowner or something, that person is often the good guy. Like that's, so you have like, that's a good, we love him, wow, that's amazing, we respect, we love, we appreciate. So if you hear a story about like a wealthy landowner, that's not seen in a negative way. That's not like watching an American movie where the camera pans from the bottom of the big tower all the way to the top and you're like, businessman is the bad guy. All right, they didn't see it that way. All right, businessman was the good guy. So if you hear a story that you hear wealthy landowner, they're thinking, want to be like him. The very common villain, as a matter of fact, the most hated person in Jewish society was who? Tax collectors. So the local IRS agents were the most hated people. Well, some things haven't changed there either. But sorry if you work for the IRS, it's really a lovely aspect of our American government. So the local tax collectors, now here's why. Let me just, again, a little context because it's got to set up the story. They were considered the sellouts. So you have Imperial Rome, and you have the purest, like in the Jewish, you know, like the purest, they were the zealots. They were fundamentalists. And they were like, no, we hate Rome, down with Rome, I swear an oath to hate Rome, I will pull the sword, we'll fight Rome. As a matter of fact, and they actually have an uprising in AD 70, and it doesn't go well for the Jews. It's a bloodbath in Jerusalem, it's bad. But that's like the purest fundamentalist, no Rome. Well, on the totally other side, you had the guys that were like, when in Rome? Not really, because it was Jerusalem, but it just seemed like it went. But they're over here going, if you can't beat them, join them. Like, I don't think Rome's going anywhere. They've been around for a few years. I'll get a job. I mean, so yeah, that's these guys. They're super pragmatists right here. And so they get a job for Rome going, hey, I'll collect the money for you. And you guys are pretty devious. I'm watching how you guys do that. I can be devious too, so I'll skim my profits off the top. And these, you know, your common person, they can't do anything about it. They got no power. So that's the dynamic. So they hate tax collectors. They're sellouts, they're ripoffs, they're cheats. Hate them. And the tax collectors typically function in a role of a manager or like a COO, the chief operations guy, because they were the ones essentially doing the bidding of the Romans. All right? There's the frame. Time for the story. In the audience would have been Pharisees, Sadducees, so you had the religious leaders were showing up to hear Jesus because they were spying on him. And you had kind of the common man as well. So kind of different strata of society. We're all listening to Jesus at the same time for some of his stories. So imagine you're the audience, and let's just paint yourself as the common person because I think that probably works for today. And Jesus gets up, he's going to tell you a story. And you've probably heard Jesus tell a bunch of stories at this point, or maybe you just walked up, but you've heard a little bit about him. And he's a good storyteller, so you get hooked pretty quick. So Jesus gets up and he says, so once upon a time, there was a wealthy landowner. Good guy. He was generous, he was kind, he was ambitious, he owned a lot of property. And he was good with his money, so he rented his property. What he did was he rented his property to other people who wanted to do agriculture and farming and other things, and they would just pay him a percentage of whatever they made. It was a good business deal. It was fair. Everybody won. Crowd right now, good guy. I want to be him. All right? Wealthy landowner. This landowner had so many business endeavors going on, he had to put some people in place, and he decided there was one man in particular that he would empower to oversee all of his land. So he hired this guy to be his chief operations officer. He was going to be the primary manager. He empowered him, he trusted him, he let him do his thing. However, he was a cheat. Low murmur in the crowd. Yeah, he was cheating not just the landowner, but he was also cheating the renters. Skimming profits, making money. Crowd, of course he was. But the wealthy landowner found out and confronted the man. I just saw The Rock last week. I know where this is going. Bring the rain, baby. Here we go. I mean, so you're feeling like, okay, there's going to be some justice, maybe revenge. And the wealthy landowner sat the man down and said, "You've been wasting my possessions. You've been cheating me. You're fired." Yeah, deserved it. So, you know, there'd be probably a tax collector hanging out listening too. Fired him. Well, the man walked away, and he was a clever man. And he thought, you know, it's going to take a little bit for the landowner to actually get the word out to all his tenants that I've been fired. And I really have more of a relationship with them than he does. I have an idea. So the mischievous, clever, shrewd manager, COO guy, sets up some meetings with the tenants. Now, it's not harvest time, so this is a little bit of a weird meeting, but he says, "Hey, I need to talk to you." So, "Oh, okay." So they come in, and he sits down with each one of them. And he says, "Hey, you're working this piece of land? Yeah, and you got olive oil? Yeah, yeah. And how much are you supposed to pay when the crop comes in? Well, I don't know, 800 gallons or I don't know. Well, I'll tell you what, you have been awesome. I mean, with the landlord and I, we were just talking about you, and we just love what you're doing with your robe, and it's just the tassels are great. And where do you get those tassels? Is that from Lydia? No, okay, yeah. Just love what you're doing. I'll tell you what, go ahead and cut it in half." "Cut what in half?" "You only have to pay half of what you were originally planning. It's discount Friday. Like, I just want you to know, we had a talk. Like, it's half? Yeah. Oh, I don't know what to say. My wife is going to freak out. Are you kidding me? I'm now going to send my kids to, like, bar mitzvah. It's going to be, I didn't even know. Oh, thank you so much." "Ah, no problem. I'm glad I could do." And, you know, the landlord, we were just talking about how wonderful. "Well, would you please pass on my love and respect to him?" "Yes, absolutely. Brings in the next guy. "Hey, what are you working on? What do you got going on the land?" "I got a bunch of wheat." "You know what? I'll tell you what. We're going to do, like, a 20% discount." "What? Why?" "Just because, you know our guy, our landowner guy. He's just so, and he is so generous. He's so generous. I just want to pass the word." "Oh, thanks, man. Can I pop like a champagne?" "Sure, yeah. I'm going to get with some of the other guys and party because the word's getting out. Like, this is amazing." "Yeah, go, you guys have a party. It's amazing." So the landowner finds out. Now, again, if you're in the crowd, you're like, "Oh, thank goodness." And a landowner walks up, calls this manager that he fired, COO guy, who's now done all the second kind of devious act, but kind of clever. He pulls him in. He says, hey, come back here. We have to have a talk." So he sits up to him and he goes, "I heard what you did with all my tenants." "Yeah. That was pretty good, actually." "Huh? I mean, that was pretty clever. I'm kind of screwed. I mean, I got two options, right? I mean, one is I call them all up and I go, 'Hey, this whole thing was a hoax. This guy lied to you. I'm throwing him in jail, and the discounts aren't real. Pay the full amount.' I'm not going to look good. Or I talk to him like I just did the wheat guy who walked in and was like, 'Thank you, thank you, thank you.' And I was like, You're welcome. So glad we could do that for you. And he went on and on about what a generous person you were. And so, you know what? It was so clever, I'm going to take it on the chin. Don't mess with me again, but you're hired, because that was pretty cool. And Jesus sits down and takes a drink of water. Out of like a wineskin or a hot, whatever that. They didn't have water bottles. So there's not even a slow clap, not like. That was an interesting story. Could we do the Good Samaritan one again? Because I like that one better.
I didn't. I hate Samaritans.
Okay. Like, this is what Jesus did all the time. He tells stories like this that just totally disrupt everything. Which, by the way, is the problem when we read the Bible, if we try to read it like it's a morality tale. I mean, this is a perfect example. You get to this one, you're like, hey, kids, we're going to do a Bible study tonight. And the master said, way to go. You were super dishonest and clever. So, kids, cheat your neighbor. This is why it's important that we understand the context of Scripture when we're reading it, is to understand what is Jesus trying to do. Jesus is trying to disrupt. He's trying to help totally disrupt their system. That this is, essentially Jesus is saying, what do you bank on? This is the question he's presenting everybody with. What is it that you bank on? In this case, the dishonest manager, who is really clever and shrewd, wound up actually with a really generous act. Something kind of positive happened in the midst of his broken motives. But ultimately, where did the shrewd, dishonest money manager, where did he place his faith? What truth did he believe in beyond all truths? He believed that the wealthy landowner was full of mercy, patience, and grace. He banked on the fact that if I do this, I think my landowner is such a man that rather than pulling the apparent generosity that was offered to his tenants and flipping it on them, I'm going to bank on the fact that generosity wins the day. Now, Jesus is using a rabbinical technique called from light to heavy. And he does this a lot. The phrase that Jesus uses, if you go back to some of these New Testament stories, this might ring a bell if you've read some of these through the years. He says, how much more? If your child asks you for a loaf of bread, do you not give him a loaf of bread? Do you instead give him a snake? No, your average father gives him a loaf of bread. How much more does your Father in heaven want to give you when you ask? So he uses a how much more. That's a technique. Basically saying, I'm going to show you a setting that's limited, and then I'm going to compare it and go, how much more? So he's going, here's a dishonest man, tainted motives, generous act, who trusts in the generosity of God, and somehow is blessed in the middle of it. How much more is your God in heaven generous? If this is a dishonest man who's trusting that God is generous, why don't you, who already have some level of truth, or you've been taught about who God is, why don't you believe that he's generous? Because you are actually not trusting in God, are you? You're trusting in your money. And this is a conversation about money. I mean, it's a conversation about a broader obedience thing. It's a conversation about grace. It is. But what he's using is money as a player. And he's basically confronting them with that very statement. Here's his next line. I'll pick it up in Luke chapter 6, 9 through 10. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you've not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. The Pharisees, verse 14, who loved money, heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. Now, this gives you an idea of how he hit home. This really unusual, disruptive story hits home. And he said to them, "You are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of others, but God knows your hearts." And what he's saying is, hey, you have tainted motives. The truth is, you're all a little bit like the dishonest manager. Give anyway. Act anyway. And continue to stay in motion and continue to find your trust in God. Here's someone with tainted motives, but who actually got the who right. Because his trust wasn't in his own behavior. Let me give you another example. The truth of the matter is, we like to think of it like this. Like today, and we'll use a number of different phrases that maybe come from your religious background. Today, I was really walking in the Spirit. Today, I was really aligned with God. Today, I was really obedient in my faith. Yesterday, I had a little struggle. Yesterday, I dealt with temptation. Yesterday, I was fraught with sin. Yesterday, I was lost in the cares of this world. We tend to really try to clean it up and make it like this day, we're totally pure, and this day, we're totally evil. The good news is, we prayed about it, and through repentance, we became good again. Can I ask you a question? The good thing? Like, how long do you hold on to that? Let me give you an example. Because most of our motives are tainted most of the time, and we don't realize it. For instance, you have some tension. Because it's easy, let's pick marriage. You have some tension. Some tension, or dating. We'll use close relationship. You have some tension. There's a disagreement among the two of you. Maybe it's intense, maybe it's not. But there's some tension. Lack of resolution. In the Spirit, you go, the Spirit's a reconciliatory Spirit. And you're in the Spirit. You go, man, we need to be reconciled. I mean, God calls us to reconcile, and we're in this tension, but I want unity in the home. I think she wants unity. Love keeps no record of wrongs. How do I look to reconnect and seek reconciliation? And your motives are the purest that you understand. You're like totally in the Spirit. In the flesh, here's your question to your wife. Hey, honey, can we talk? Pure motives, best you understand, like want to reconcile. Or codependency is, if you're not okay, I'm not okay. You go, there's all this tension. This tension's freaking me out. I hate it. It's so weird. And she's wrong anyway. Or he's wrong anyway, and someone needs to confront her with her sin, and I don't like the fact that she's mad at me, and so depending on who you are, you're one person that'll be like, I'm gonna bring the rain, or you're the person that's like, I didn't do anything wrong, but I'm gonna say I'm sorry anyway, because I just want there to be peace. And so what do you say? Hey, honey, can we talk? Same behavior. Same exact behavior, two totally different motives. This happens all the time. Because we tend to think like, oh, like I'm walking in the Spirit or I'm struggling with sin. Every day, wheat and tares, they grow together. And some of you might be like, no, but I know. Like I was, that first one, man, I was like right there. Like, I want to be reconciled. Honey, can we talk? Fine. Suddenly you're over in the leg. Now I'm going to bring the ring. Like, I was right there in the Spirit. Not anymore. Like, do you see how fast it changes for us? And this is the message. Jesus is saying, if you're counting on your own behavior, it's going to be rough. Because it changes like that. You are flesh and spirit, saint and sinner. And there is, as God gives you the awareness, you realign, you receive his forgiveness, you repent. But that's just an ongoing thing. I think sometimes some of us, we grew up like it was an event thing, like, oh, once a week I should get around to a repenting. No, I mean, like, it should be like in the moment, like, oh, yep, okay, back in line. It's meant to be in the rhythm of it that we're not counting on our behavior to get right with God. We're banking on his grace. We're banking on his generosity. If a dishonest, tainted motive money manager can do that, can't we? Who is it that we trust? No man can serve two masters. You can't serve both God and money. A friend of mine says this, money is a form of energy. If you literally look at money like it's energy, and in this case, of course, there's a story about, it's a whole story about money and how money's being managed and held and so forth. Who do you trust? How often do you click, you're looking at your bank account, and if the number isn't a certain number, do you feel this stress? If you're looking at your bank account and it's not where it's supposed to be in your mind, does it elicit a dark energy in you? Do you feel a darkness? Because in that moment, just to be honest with yourselves, just be like, well, I'm shifting my allegiance right now. I trust in my money. Honey, what are you doing? I'm worshiping my God. Oh, who's your God today, money? Looking at the bank account. My act of worship. How's it going? Terrible. I'm really miserable with this God. This God beats the out of me. Why do you keep worshiping that God? I don't know. False sense of control, security. Or do you trust grace? And for others of us, it's just different things. You trust your skill set. You trust your wisdom. You trust your smarts. You trust your work ethic. Or at the end of the day, do you bank on grace? So the difference is in the energy. Is it dark or is it light? When it comes to money, do you know the number one way? If you go, how would I know? Like, how do I know if I'm like in a dark energy, or how do I know if like that's become an attachment or idolatry to me? The number one way to test it is to give it away. So here's my encouragement. I got two things for you today. One is an issue of the heart, and the second is an issue of action. Okay, so the first is a heart issue. Today, would you be honest with yourself and ask yourself the question, who is it ultimately that you trust? Where do you place your trust? Is it in your bank account? Is it in your skills? Is it in your knowledge? Is it in behavior modification? Because if you can modify your behavior, some of you perfectionists, one on the Enneagrams, if you can just get that behavior right, God will love you. Right? So pick whatever your thing is. Or will you let go of those lies and go, no, I trust in grace. I trust in the generosity of the great wealthy landowner who, by the way, created it all. So first question, where's my trust? Second is, what's my action? So here's my challenge for you. Go give money away. Give it to Journey. Give it to Compassion. Give it to a neighbor in need. Not because Journey needs it, not because your neighbor necessarily needs it, or because an NGO needs it, but maybe because you need it. You need to give it away. Because right now it's got you locked up. You go, how do I know? Test it. Give something away. And if you go, weird, God told me to give this to you. That's probably a pretty good check-in. Just feel the energy. Check in with yourself. What are you trusting? And if you can go, hey, we give online here, we give in boxes. If it's here, or if it's God calls you to some other thing this week, you go, this is good. This is really good. Blessings. Be blessed. God bless this as it goes. Money's not neutral. That's the lie. Money's always bought an equitable exchange. In the kingdom, grace is not an equitable exchange. It's an ocean that's been poured out upon us. Money's not neutral. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. It's a mechanism in capitalism. We use it as an equitable thing. But just know what, call it what it is. And don't let it become your God. And he's going after money, but it can be lots of things. But you remember today that at a baseline, most of our decisions are about fear and love. We can walk in fear, condemnation, judgment. A lot of us have the own voice in our head, let alone somebody else. Or you can live in love. That's the great gift. That's the message. Would you pray with me? Before the band leads us, would you, let's do a space of contemplation. So just put both feet on the floor, maybe hands in your lap. Take a couple of deep breaths. Some space for reflection. How about let's start this morning by just listening. Would you let God know that you're available, you're listening? What is his spirit saying to you? Is there anything you want to say back to God? Perhaps you've already engaged him in dialogue, but if not yet, is there just something you need to speak out? Speak out a lie that's been stuck. Speak out a truth to be reinforced. Anything you want to acknowledge with you, him? Some conversation with the Father, however he prompts you. Father, I confess, I often trust in so many other things than grace. And while it's in my head, it's a knowledge I hold on to that I believe you to be generous. It often doesn't translate out in my state of being. There's an absence of peace because that belief hasn't dropped into my heart and soul. Father, I open myself up to that, just to really, really settle into understanding that you are a great God of deep generosity. Father, I receive forgiveness for the pressure I place on myself, the lack of compassion, the intensity of behavior modification, trying to reorient myself in the world rather than stopping first to be loved. I intercede for my brothers and sisters in here. God, if there's anyone here today who just came in hopeless, full of despair about their career, their marriage, some other meaningful relationship, a health issue, God, would you settle them into grace and love? Would that be the starting place? All the questions that they're longing to have answered, God, would you let those drift away for a moment? Let them be in love. Remind them that they're your children. And there is great joy and peace in being in you. Thank you that you make yourself available to us in total. Of course, the great gift of Jesus is that ever-present reminder. Hear from us as we sing, pray, and praise. Give you worship out of a heart of gratitude. In Jesus' name, amen.